Blog Talk Radio.
Good to see you, friends, and welcome to the Singularity Network Hangout and the World Transform. World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here to tell you so much about the future as we are to talk to you about your future and to ask you to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with considering and acting on the vast possibilities that lie before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that astounding future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and I'm very pleased to welcome a distinguished panel of Singularity Network and or World Transform participants who are joining us this evening. And what I thought I would do, gang, is why don't we do this? We'll start out by, we'll just go down the line, and we'll have everyone introduce themselves, give your name, and tell why you're interested in the Singularity. We're here representing the Singularity Network. And I think that would be an awesome way to start. And actually, I'll kick it off so everybody else has time to think about that question that I just sprang on all of you. Why I'm interested in the Singularity is because I'm very interested in this whole project, this whole process, this whole phenomenon that we might call humanity, that we might call civilization. I think of it as a very exciting, very suspenseful story, and I'm eager to see where the story goes next. I'm eager to see what the next chapter brings, and there are few more compelling images for what the future might be than that which is represented in the Singularity. A lot of people are skeptical about the Singularity, skeptical about what it will be, whether it will occur, when it will occur, but I think that whole discussion is fascinating, and talking with skeptics or talking with people who are thoroughly convinced it's about to happen, it's all very interesting. So that's me. Let's take it over to Stephen Gordon.
Hey, Phil. I'm Stephen Gordon. I guess my interest in the Singularity probably dates from my reading of Kurzweil's book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. Since then, I guess I've been interested in the Singularity primarily as a maybe as a survival trait as much as anything. Something as profound as accelerating change. You better be ready for it. You better understand what's happening. There's just the difference between surfing the future or being swamped. So that's my thought on it.
Very good. All right. Well, better to have a clue what's happening than to be swamped. Next up, we've got our buddy Sean Thuris. Sean, welcome.
Hey, everybody. Thank you. My name's Sean Thuris. I'm here in rainy and cold Yonkers, New York. And I'm interested in the project of transcending human nature and telepathy eventually. We'll see that someday.
Telepathy. Well, do you know what I'm thinking now?
No, I don't, because it's not yet 2050.
I was going to say, it's time to introduce PJ. All
right. Very good, Phil. I'm here because I'm passionately interested in where we're going, how we're going to get there, and how do we deal with the different visions of what the future could bring. I'm a little upset that Phil stole my story metaphor. thanks, Phil.
That's what happens when we talk first, see?
I know, exactly. And I've been interested in this since I was a child. I didn't know there were words like singularity or transhumanism until quite late in my life, but apparently I was always interested in that. So I'd like to see where all of this goes and maybe help push it a little bit in one direction or the other.
Absolutely. All right. Next, you, sir.
Philip van Netterveld.
Greetings, everybody. Phil, thanks for having me. I am here because I love life and I want a lot more of it. transhumanism and the possible futures ahead of us, they beckon me because I want to transcend the limits of our biology, in particular, the fact that death is still something that is externally forced upon us and not something optional yet. So my work and my life are dedicated to helping realize these visions of formerly science fiction and make them into day-to-day realities for everybody.
Awesome. All right. Well, it's going to be a hard one for anybody to top that, I think. Paul, are you with us tonight as a participant or just a spectator?
Sure, I can participate.
All right. Let's hear it. What's got you interested in the singularity?
Well, I'll take a little bit more of a longer approach to get to there. I started thinking when I was 13, I wanted to decide what I wanted to do with my life. And so I started kind of think, what's the most important thing I could possibly do with my meager life? And so I started studying Aristotle, Plato, Socrates. I learned what those guys had to say, different religions. And then I got into, I did some research on, the guy in the wheelchair, black holes.
Stephen Hawking.
I did some research project on Stephen Hawking, George Orwell. So I just started doing a lot of research to try to figure out where I wanted to go in life. And I decided that I really thought what kind of bound us together in humanity was a quest for peace, prosperity, and a better tomorrow. That both individually and collectively, we're searching for that as humanity. And I decided that, I started trying to learn more about leadership, about economics. I got my degree in economics and then a degree in law, all along that quest. And along the way, I discovered the singularity is near. I was listening to an NPR report where I heard this guy who sounded like he was just so full of himself and so assured of how his predictions were coming true left and right about technological innovations. And I said, well, let me see if this guy's really full of it or not. So I read his book, and I was very happy to see that he was taking a technological approach to making the world a better place. And I was very happy to see that it really fit well into my ideas about how to transition peacefully from where we are today into where I hope humanity can be.
Next panelist, Nicola, take it away.
Hi, guys. Name is Nick. Some of you may know me as Socrates. I've been living and breathing singularity and transhumanism for maybe 6 or 7 years now, from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep, pretty much. The thing is, I'm still not sure I'm making any progress in figuring out which way we're going and is it good or bad. I fluctuate on different days and after conversations with different people. I tend to be optimistic, but not always. So, yeah, I'm just trying to figure out where we're heading and what can we do to steer the ship in the best direction possible, because there's lots of bad signs that we might not be doing it. And there are some good signs. And hopefully conversations like this one would help humanity in general figure out either the direction that we need to go towards or how the hell do we steer that ship. And most of all, not panic. So that's all. Don't
the
panic.
Old advice from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, huh? Don't panic. Okay. All right. Jason.
Hello, I'm Jason. I'm a community organizer here at TerraSim in Melbourne Beach, Florida. And in high school, I read Max Moore's website and Ben Best's website, and that inspired me towards reading more about the singularity and transhumanism. But it was only about a year ago that I started going to a lot of events in the San Francisco Bay Area related to the singularity and transhumanism, and I found it very inspiring. I like the idea of life extension, and also the future of, you know, superhuman robots who might become more intelligent than humans and create more superhuman robots. And yes, I eventually moved to Florida to join TerraSem, and TerraSem is kind of more of a spiritual transhumanist organization that views humanity as a collective heading towards immortality and diversity and unity. So, these topics have generally been interesting to me, and I like to read about it.
Okay, very good. All right, on to Frank.
Hi there, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I got into transhumanism and the singularity through anti-aging medicine. I started the blog and started researching anti-aging medicine, and I started from scratch, read books, surfed the web, and transhumanism concepts are always kind of out there. Of course, radical life extension is a transhumanist idea, but then I got exposed to mind uploading and cryonics and things like that. Ray Kurtz, I had a very successful blog on anti-aging back then, and Ray Kurtz Vile sent me his book, The Singularity, and I read that. Of course, that is kind of a the textbook, I guess, of the singularity. The next thing was things went sour on this planet. Peak oil, I read about peak oil. Then there was the financial crash of 2008, unemployment, global problems, and it looked like things are going in the opposite direction of a singularity. It looks like they were just disintegrating. So I spent a lot of time researching that. And so, unlike Nicola, I guess, I'm kind of in between. Are we going to go to the singularity, or is it just going to destroy the planet? So I think right now I'm taking the singularity route, because the destruction of the planet thing, there's not much I can do about it except just watch it. That's my story.
Given a choice, most of us would, I think, prefer the singularity over the destruction of the world scenario, for sure. I don't want to speak for anyone else, but I definitely go that way. Hey, before we jump into our topics, one other thing. I gave my spiel for The World Transformed here at the beginning of the Hangout, and I thought it would be a good idea if we got somebody from Singularity Network to just say a few words about what that group is and what they're all about. And Paul, I don't know, would you like to step in and address that?
Sure. Singularity Network. Started by Jean-Sebastien and a few others, I kind of came in after it started. He asked me to be the vice president there, but the idea was to first create a forum where these ideas can start to be shared and we can start building a community around it. Next, we're kind of dividing the group up into a bottom-up approach and a top-down approach. As far as one is, we'll be looking at more of a grassroots movement, which is what this podcast is kind of gearing towards. It's informing more people and getting them excited about it. The other is the top-down approach is, you know, more providing tools wherein people who now are getting educated about these ideas can start to apply and collaborate to actually make those things happen. So that's where we're at with Singularity Network. The group on Facebook has been growing. We're on other platforms as well, growing. And we hope we can utilize that to bring about a singularity that we can all not only live with, but be happy living with.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Okay, so let's kick this off. We have several topics that we can get into, and I'm going to open the discussion up to any topics that the panelists would care to share with us as well. Plus, we've got a few questions that have come in from folks who are watching the broadcast as we go. But our first topic that we talked about spending some time on this evening is that of the quantified self. And I believe, Philip, that you had some updates on what's happening with the roadmap for the quantified self.
Phil, can I jump in real quick? I just wanted to give a quick thanks to Phil and to Jason for taking the time to organize this hangout. And I want to thank each and every one of our panelists for taking the time and even waiting a little bit to get this thing started. We appreciate your time, and your time is the most important thing you can be giving at this very moment to help this moving along. So I really appreciate you guys giving your time to this meeting, this hangout. Okay, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Thanks for saying that, Paul. I don't know that anyone actually organized this event. I think that might be an overstatement to describe it as organized, but we're doing our best. Okay. Take it away. The question is to you, Philip. Update on the quantified self.
Okay, well, I've been interested in quantified self and quantifying myself as well for many years now. As a runner, I have the Nike sports watch, and I tried the Fitbit and some other self-quantifying devices, and I keep buying, to the chagrin of my wife, I keep buying more. To see which one works better, etc., and backing Kickstarter campaigns, etc. In September of this year, I was lucky to reunite forces with an old friend of mine, Dr. Anita Goel, and I first met her in 1999 at the Foresight Institute Nanotechnology Congress and conference, the technical conference, where she was awarded a student prize in the context of the Feynman Prizes for the optical tweezers that she had developed as a student. And so fast forward to today, last month, or no, not in September, I mean, I flew to Boston, where she has her office. Her company's called NanoBioSim, and I was able to help her do the final preparations, a three-minute video, as well as a Steve Jobs-like presentation to a jury of her gene radar invention and product. And to make a long story short, at the end of the month, this was her entry of her company into the X Challenge, which is one of the X prizes. In this case, it was for sensing, which is kind of the preamble before the tricorder prize. And out of all the contestants, this had been going on for a couple of years, the pre-selections, etc., she won. And so I've shared the link of the announcement of her win in the text chat, the group chat window. So you can go there and you can see the three-minute video that I produced for Anita and to explain the gene radar. And it was, why is this of interest? Well, because as a quantified selfer, working with Anita and getting really up close with what she's been working on enabled me to understand the future, the details of the future roadmap of quantified self and how it will have an enormous impact on health extension and life extension and health span extension and possibly even immortality. So what Anita developed is a new technology for scanning your diseases by means of, you put a little bit of blood in a optical chip, and then using nanotechnology that she's developed, in under an hour, any diseases that you may have can be identified and correctly diagnosed based on their DNA signature. And so it's an enormous progress in diagnostics. And that same technology can be applied in other formulations. The first version that she has is transportable. It's not even portable. But if all of you have an opportunity to watch the 3-minute video that that I created to help her with her bid for the XPRIZE, you will see a small section which shows the roadmap of her technology and the next products that she wants to bring out. So the first version that's today, the Gene Radar, is a small laptop-sized device where you put the optical chip in, and in under an hour and for a couple of bucks, you can get a accurate diagnostics of any diseases that you might have, AIDS or anything else. And so this in itself revolutionizes medicine because it brings down the cost of diagnosing AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa from hundreds of dollars, which they don't have, to just a few dollars and under an hour instead of having to wait up to 6 weeks or longer to get a diagnostic. The next step will be a accessory for smartphones. So the same technology that is now the size of a small laptop will be shrunk further into an accessory that you plug into your iPhone or your Galaxy or Android smartphone. And this will enable people to diagnose themselves at home whenever they fancy. It will be very low cost. You can do this every day if you like. And the next generation after that will be in the form of a dermal patch that you can slap on yourself, and it will measure not only diseases but other states of your health through analysis using the same nanotechnology of sweat, etc. And then the next generation after that, we get into ingestibles, which is sensors that you can swallow, injectables, which is sensors that you can inject using a syringe, and then implantables, sensors that you can permanently locate somewhere in your body to give via wireless communication permanent readings on not only your vital statistics, but many, many other parameters of your health. The same technology will also be deployed in non-wearable or non-portable forms in the following sense. You will either buy a new toilet or something that you can dangle inside of the bowl of your toilet, which will analyze every time you or one of your family goes to where everybody goes alone, you will be able to have an analysis of your urine or your stool. So if you combine all of these things together, this is what happens to quantified self and how it helps you dramatically increase your health span. You will have an ever-shortening feedback loop between the measurement of all your vitals, including daily your stool, your urine, your blood. You will have a daily blood work, in other words, all your other vital signs will be permanently recorded and stored securely in the cloud. And there will be software that will be analyzing your data continuously in real time. And it will be probably a kind of a narrow focus AI, which is like a doctor, and which is doing a diagnostic of your state of health on the fly all the time. And it will give you input as to what you need to do there and then in order to optimize your health, increase your health span, deal with a particular disease that has cropped up. And so the a technology that will go hand in hand with this is the already in development 3D printing of medication. So imagine that next to your bed you will have a little device, and every morning when you get up it will spit out either a small drink or a pill or a set of pills or maybe a dermal patch which you will eat, and that pill will contain exactly what your body needs based on all the data that have been measured over the last 12 hours or 24 hours. So during the night, after computing your data, you will have a pharmacy literally next to your bed that will give you the medication or supplements that you need and which will be hyper-personalized to your specific body, genes, and your recent activities and data. So it's not only the pill or the little drink that it will make for you, it will also tell you, like, you know, you really need to go and maybe run a couple miles today or at least have 10,000 steps today. And it will also analyze what you're eating. And with using the same nanotechnology again, it will see everything that goes into your body and everything that leaves your body and how your body is coping with the inputs and the outputs, and thereby make that feedback loop between measurement, analysis, diagnosis, and intervention extremely short, thereby enabling you to act promptly on anything that might crop up which might jeopardize your health, be it an aging symptom or a virus or a bacteria or whatever is assailing your body. I think that's pretty exciting.
That is very exciting. It's fascinating stuff you're talking about, Philip. The first thing that comes to mind when you describe this world wherein we're truly enjoying quantified self-technology around our own health is the contrast between how that will work and what the reality is for most people today, right? Because when you think about how often do most people get a blood draw done, right, sent to the lab? Either they've gotten really sick and they go to the doctor and they have it done for that, or if they're conscientious, dutiful people doing what they should do, they'll go in once a year and get an annual physical and have it done. If they haven't had any symptoms, once a year they get a blood draw. And only if something's wrong are they going to have their urine checked or anything else checked, right? Contrast that with every day you're having that vital information reported to you, and then having a device that's going to, in real time, correct what's happening with your body. It seems to me that the biggest hurdle around that 3D printer of medicine on your nightstand is not going to be a technological hurdle. It'll be a regulatory hurdle. That's my one. My one fear about what you're describing there, but I want to open this up to the panel now. Responses to the awesome roadmap that Philip just laid out for us, and or thoughts on maybe some intermediate quantified self steps that people could be taking or are already taking. Anyone just want to chime in on any of those things?
Actually, I have something that's timely. My wife and I got these 23andMe kits in the mail. If you noticed, the FDA sent them a nasty letter a few days ago, and it's all over the tech and business news. What exactly is going to happen with that? But anyway, that's almost a plaything compared to the stuff that Philippe was talking about. But that's my quantified self contribution.
Very good. Well, that's more than I've done. I can tell you who else? You know what? I use WeightBot on my iPhone, and I hate that app. I hate it very much. That's all I have to say.
Ringing endorsement.
It's because it's good. It works. Okay. Others who are quantifying themselves or who have comments on the quantified self roadmap.
Bill, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. Because I think my camera's frozen.
Oh. Yeah.
I'm so fascinated by this regulatory issue with 23andMe because it's the tip of the iceberg, given, again, what Philip's talking about. You're 100% correct. It's the regulatory hurdles, the fact that you could become your own pharmacy, that in essence all you would need would be the building blocks, the chemical building blocks of medicine. We will need a very big shift in the social contract before that happens.
Well, you know, the issue there, PJ, is that the doctor gets worked out of the loop, right? There's a lot of interest that people have in their own kind of livelihood in their own profession that they'll want to protect, and that protection will probably, you think, take the form of regulatory opposition to this sort of thing?
Let me speak to that perhaps briefly. Christine Peterson, who also is very much into this topic, jokingly says, you know, in the future we're all going to fire our GP. And based on what I described, that sounds plausible. However, with regards to the societal shift that may be needed, the hurdle is lower if you use technology to satisfy the vested interests of pharmacists and doctors. For instance, the software that will be doing the ongoing diagnosis of your data will have to probably have a doctor in the loop somewhere who will sign off and who will probably, you know, make a few cents on every time he signs off on a diagnosis and on a prescription. And then for the pharmacist, they will probably do something similar for pharmacists so that they can get an income stream from this. But also, with regards to preventing potential abuse of chemicals that you would have on your nightstand, they can produce containers that are tamper-proof in the sense that they would contain feedstock of certain medication. However, if you attempt to directly access those containers, like, you know, with morphine or whatever, the tampering would destroy the contents of the container, and thereby that would be a relatively safe way or secure way that they could prevent you from people from abusing and starting to self-medicate in unsafe ways.
Yeah, let me jump in real quick on that. I mean, we're all familiar with the differences between, say, getting an iPhone or an Android. You know, the idea that one platform is pretty much locked in. You know, they don't want you messing with it at all. And there's a lot of people out there who aren't going to want to mess with it. They don't want to take the time to learn how to use their iPiss or whatever it's going to be called. You know, they don't want to take the time to do that. They're just going to leave it in the hands of professionals, and they're going to wait for the professionals to tell them which drugs to take, how much, when to take it. But it's going to be, I mean, you know, it's the same crisis we run into as far as politics are concerned, any economics. Most people don't want to spend the time to learn these things. Most people don't want to spend the time to do it. They're so wrapped up in getting the day-to-day taken care of. A lot of people aren't going to spend the time to get to know how the technology works, how to hack it, how to get into it, and then they're going to be people that do. I think Philip's absolutely right. There's still going to be plenty of room for regulation in the beginning until the point where maybe technology is smart enough that it's making better decisions than the doctors are, than the human doctors are. Well, I have that video if we wanted to watch it. I don't know if we want to take some time for that now. It's a 3-minute thing. I can push it in to see.
You know, we've not been having an awful lot of luck with the technology tonight. I don't think we want to try broadcasting a video. But I'll tell you what, let's include that link in the in the event and over on Singularity Network, so people can check that out. That and Philip, your link as well to the video you were talking about. Anyone else with thoughts on the? Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, just to add in what I'm kind of a hobbyist bodybuilder, and I just started the intermittent fasting program, so that's what I'm doing with the Quantified Self. I'm doing the 16 to 18 hour day fast, and then trying to get all my calories in that window for eating. So that's my current experiment of quantifying myself. Okay, that's all I have.
Do you use any particular technology for that, Paul?
Spoon, fork, knife, stove. you know. Local shopping center. You know, I use some protein shakes every now and then. I'm not a fan of dairy, so I go with carnivore because it's supposed to be mostly protein. It does have a little bit of whey in there, but it's mostly a beef protein. I don't know how they powder beef, but it looks like I'm drinking some type of powdered beef.
Well, it sounds delicious. Okay. Now, between Paul with his law degree, we've actually got... I've just got to go ahead and out you here, Stephen. We've actually got a lawyer here on the panel. So, do you have thoughts on these regulatory issues around the quantified self? And let me frame the question to you this way, Stephen. We talk a lot about, on the World Transformed, we talk a lot about the self-driving car and how it's got a certain inevitability to it because eventually they're going to be better than people and lives will be saved and no matter what arguments anybody has against it, you can't really argue against saving 50,000 plus lives a year. Well, ultimately, the kinds of technology Philip is talking about can save millions of lives every year, certainly improve millions of lives, and I think potentially save them. But will it be a harder row to hoe to make that case and to overcome the kinds of resistance that we expect to see to these kinds of developments, do you think?
PJ is exactly right. We've got a long way to go in changing the way we look at and operate as a society. I think that the recent developments in the legalizing of marijuana, of all things. Now, I mean, I'm not saying that's a route to health by any means, but what I would say is that the very fact that people are saying, you know, I have a right to alter my consciousness or do various things, the fact that that's being pushed in places like Colorado, Phil, where you are, and in other states, and successfully, I think that tends to move society a little more in the direction of I have a right to what goes on in my own body, and I have a right to regulate that myself. That's swinging the pendulum a little more in that direction, a little less away from a paternalistic government deciding how things are done. But we have a long way to go before the regulatory issues are changed to the point where we can just say, not only have I diagnosed my own health problem, but I'm also using high throughput computational, material science to develop the drug that I need at this very moment to take to alleviate that problem. It'll be a much different world when we get there, and obviously the laws will have to change a lot to allow that. I think there'll be just a lot of people that say, you know what, I don't care, and there'll be a lot of law breaking to the point that it'll be a little bit like prohibition. Probably, the law will change because it's just rampant breaking of the law to the point that people are it's beginning to erode the respect for the law, and so law will have to change because of that. It might go that way. It'd be a little bit more like prohibition, where people just decide what they're going to do and do it, and the law has to change as a result of it.
However it works, you definitely see the law following the reality, don't you?
Right, yeah. Absolutely. Politicians, as a rule, lead from the rear, and that's both parties.
Okay. Anyone else? Anyone else feel the need have something to share with us on the quantified self, or want to tell us how they're quantifying their own lives before we move on to our next topic? Jump in. Go ahead.
Quickly, I just want to say two things. One is I am quantifying myself right now. I'm not using anything like the FitBand. I'm simply doing a lot of blood and saliva tests. I'm monitoring sort of the very deep levels of my health, seeing how much I can change it through diet and exercise, and it's been pretty amazing what I've been able to change. Certainly seeing through blood tests, the reality of that's been amazing. That's been fascinating, but what I really wanted to address was Stephen's point, which is, we're going to have, and this may lead into a new question, Phil, so maybe this will be helpful.
All right.
We have two very big issues with the short-term approach to the singularity, where we're still working with our bodies as we relatively recognize them. We're going to have bodily liberty, which is what Stephen's actually talking about. We're going to have cognitive liberty. And or lack thereof. As we develop more technologies to closely analyze the workings of both our bodies and our minds and the adjusting of our bodies and our minds, there is going to be a conflict between what individuals want and what society says it wants. And the whole notion of both bodily liberty and cognitive liberty is going to be enormous.
Okay, so the question is, what are we going to do about that, I guess?
Sorry to hang it out like that.
Yeah, that's where you take it. So what do we do with this, conflict between what society wants in terms of, let me make sure I understand, what society wants in terms of how smart we can all get or how capable we can all become physically, or what we can do with it. You know, what kind of, give some examples of what kind of interest society has in that,
For instance, there's the use of nootropics, where you would call them smart drugs. Right now, there are drugs that people feel that for themselves enhance them mentally, be it medicinal, Adderall, there's a host of different drugs. Our society says, oh, no, those are pharmaceuticals. They can only be used with a prescription. It is illegal to both take and to sell these drugs to people who we believe should not have them, off-label use, et cetera. In terms of bodily issues, we see it throughout medicine. You can't just have elective surgery on anything you want. If you say, oh, wow, I'd like to make my arms longer, or I'd like you to give me brain surgery because I think it's going to help me, nobody's going to give that to you. There has to be a significant deficit for people to want to change you. Now, we have laws that dictate the hygiene of things like body modification, but you know, no one's breaking into your house to stop you, to stop a body mod from, you know, making themselves look like Worf. However, there will soon be, I believe, a far greater insistence on making sure that medical procedures that we may view as happily elective are controlled as more people start to DIY themselves.
Interesting. And do you think it's a matter of these things becoming something that gets moved out of the system, so it's something that your health insurance won't cover, or it's something that, you know, the Affordable Care Act, right, wouldn't cover? The government's not going to step in and do it, and that people would then be forced to do on their own, which is how quantified self works anyway. Or are you saying it goes farther than that, and these things actually become illegal?
Well, look at it this way. There are plenty of people who are not allowed to do, who, in our country, we're not allowed to do stem cell therapies for the most part. There are some very narrow uses that they're allowed to be used at experimentally, but the really radical forms of stem cell therapies, I have no idea whether they work or not. I'm not saying that they're that this is a proven therapy, but there's lots of medical tourism going out of the country to Asia in search of stem cell therapy. I think a lot of this modification is going to happen through medical tourism. I think there will be countries that try to lock it down, and I think there are going to be countries that say, come on in. You know, it's all on.
Yeah.
Right.
Agreed.
Okay. Others, thoughts on the future tension that PJ is describing? Is this something we need to be concerned about? I'll tell you where it feels to me like that ends us up. This is the podcast we did a couple of weeks ago with Zoltan Istvan and a few weeks before that with Ramaz Nam. One of the subjects that kept coming up is this potential coming war between humans and transhumans, humans and posthumans. And these would be the not even the opening salvos in that war, but the beginnings of the conflict. If that conflict is ever going to occur, that would start us down that path. What do people think? Is this a thing we need to be concerned about? And what do we do about it? How do we pave a path to the future that's going to enable us to enjoy the capabilities that technology is providing us? Nick, what do you think? We haven't heard from you in a few minutes.
Well, if I'm to speculate here, I would say that there's two things. First of all, the American context and the global context. In the American context, I'm willing to bet that there's 100 other reasons for going into civil war before transhumanism pops into the scene. Like it or not, at least it seems to me from Canada and from visiting pretty often that people are polarized for a number of other issues, extremely militarized and armed in some cases. Like I went to visit my wife's aunt in Ohio. She has 5 guns in her bedroom, and she was telling me she has the special bullets to, you know, if you don't kill him, he's going to drop down from the shock, etc. So putting the joke aside, in the American context, there seems to be so much polarization for other issues that transhumanism is not even on the radar. In the global context, the good news is that I don't see it as an issue which would lead to global conflict. In other words, if you look at cultures and going back to elective operations, I know that in China for a number of years already people have been doing elective surgeries to enhance their height, for example. I was watching a documentary almost maybe 2 years ago about how a number of well-off women in China get anywhere between 1 to 2 inches of height after undergoing those operations. And not that I'm recommending them, but I'm just saying that it seems that there is a market, and it seems that there are people who are willing to provide that, and I didn't see any necessary backlash. Also in cultures like the Japanese culture, people generally tend to look a lot, it seems to me, a lot more open-mindedly on modifications and enhancements with the help of technology. So I don't see, for example, the Japanese society going up in arms against each other, divided between transhumanists and anti-transhumanists. Right, so to put it briefly, to me it seems that in the American context, transhumanism is not on the radar. There are other issues which are more likely to bring conflict, if hopefully not, but if there is to be any conflict, I see other issues that are more controversial at the moment. And on the global context, the good news is that I don't think it would be so necessarily militarizing. And again, there are many other more pertinent issues to the problems that we're facing today. That's my take.
Good. Okay. I like it. No shooting war. I tend to agree that that things won't get that bad.
By the way, I recently interviewed Ramesh. I'm coming from Seattle just 3 days ago or something. Was it 3 days ago? Maybe a week ago. I don't know. Time is a blur for me. But we did 4 interviews in 1 day with Greg Bear, Ramesh Nam, William Hertling, and maybe 3 interviews. I don't know. Everything's been a blur. But
get out of here. How? Wait a minute. How blown was your mind by the end of that day, for crying out loud?
It totally was. That's why everything's a blur. But that was one of the questions that I've been asking, and most even science fiction writers seem to be pessimistic. Even people who write books like William Hurtling, The AI Apocalypse, or Ramesh Nam, who wrote Nexus and Crux, and in one of his books, there's one of his Chinese characters, who is the post-human woman, says there's a war coming. And so I asked him during the interview, so Ramesh, do you think there is a war coming? And I think he elaborated on it, but the long answer was no, not really. Yeah. Right. So it helps the author, if you're a sci-fi author or if you're in a Hollywood movie, to set the situation in the context of conflict for a number of reasons. But and of course, that doesn't mean that reality is impossible to imitate such an outcome. But I just think that right now, at least the way I perceive it, it's not so likely.
All right. Good. Others, thoughts on the conflict in the U.S. or globally, that can occur on a social level between those who want the freedom to modify themselves, enhance themselves as they see fit, and those who think there should be limits on that. Do others see a big fight coming? Paul, go ahead. Paul?
Yeah, I just had to unmute myself. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if some of you are familiar with, there's a young man who decided to start making guns with a 3D printer. And there was a lot of people up uproar about that, and he found out that in order for him to actually make arms, he had to submit an application to become an arms dealer. And he submitted the application, was approved to become an arms dealer, and is now able to manufacture and sell weapons. And people didn't realize once he filed this paperwork and everything seemed to be in order, what was actually going on. They thought he was, some big manufacturing company. And then they found out that it was just this one guy who's
with a 3D printer. Wow.
On his 3D printer. And, there's not much people can do about it right now. He's done a lot of things to help keep himself from going to jail and all this and that. And maybe I have some facts wrong about the case. But in a way, what he did was he went through the proper channels that are currently there. And I think what's going to happen is we're going to see that all you book readers out there who no longer care about, being a good orator and speaking in public, now that you have all these books, you're totally going to destroy your mind's ability to remember things, and your memory's going to go down the drain. Fine, you go ahead and read those books, and I'm going to be the best speechwriter ever or speaker ever. I think that's what's going to happen is that things that work, and we're going to find a way to add it into our society eventually, whether or not the current rules follow that system. And those there's going to be people who care, people who don't care, but if it works, it works. We're still these beasts of survival. If it's going to help us survive and achieve, we're going to find a way to go after that one way or another. And there's people who are going to be more aggressive about that and less aggressive about that based on where they're at in life.
But the question is, how do you decide what works? Because everything in terms of what works and what doesn't work is context-specific. So your background, your cultural background is very important, your religious background, your philosophical, even your political background, which all have implications about your goals and thereby have implications about whether something works or not, because people with different goals would find that the same tool can work for or against, and therefore you can have total misalignment of different kinds of groups. And also there's certain time frame within which you really don't know if something works or it doesn't. You know, there was recently a lot of noise made in Canada about that surgery that alleviates supposedly, I think, MLS, about sort of expanding the neck veins that people had problems with and thereby alleviating the symptoms. And there was very substantial scientific research done. A lot of people rushed in, did the surgery in Poland and in a bunch of other places, basically with the best of intentions, and then it turned out it doesn't work. And so what works and what doesn't work, is it takes a long time to figure out, and it's very culturally specific. It depends entirely on your goals, on your starting point, on your cultural biases, on the outcomes you're going after. So I think
if you take a long-term look at what works and what doesn't work, or what works better and what doesn't work better, if you kind of go back to your caveman days where people were making different types of arrowheads, and one guy found out that he can make a arrowhead that worked better than the last guy, and there's this churning of ideas. And, yeah, it does take time. There's competition. And there may be things that would work better, but during that time period, they didn't work. And so that's a good reason to keep the history and to reinvestigate things that didn't work in the past but may work now. But it's all just this big competition. Yeah, and it takes time to figure out. It takes time cross-culturally and everything else. But penicillin is pretty cool. It works for a lot of people in a lot of great ways. And to absolutely ignore it, might not leave you in the best place, and you may actually die out if you decide, you know, penicillin should be ignored no matter what.
I agree, but we have bacteria that's resistant to penicillin today,
sure,
because it's been overused and overprescribed. And therefore, sure, what used to work 60 years ago doesn't seem to be as effective and work the same things that it was able to treat 60 years ago. And the situation is getting actually worse in terms of the efficacy of all those antibiotics. We're running out of them, actually, right? So it's an arms race.
I agree. Well, you know, I think we're going to keep fighting. I'm not ready to roll over and die yet. I don't think there are many people who are, but, you know, that's just it. We're just going to keep pushing forward.
We're going to have to do something about this antibiotics thing, but I think that's a little wide of our agenda tonight. Although that is a huge problem, and I've been reading about it, and it's a very scary problem, actually, what happens when antibiotics just don't work anymore. But Nick, actually, as I was thinking about it, the example you gave of the procedure that didn't work actually seems to line up pretty well with what Paul was saying, because they tried it, right? You know, if something doesn't work, but you got to try it, that's the important thing.
I agree, but at what cost, right? Because sometimes you try something and you die. You know, and that's why when it comes to biohacking and stuff, I consider myself, you know, sort of cutting-edge tech person. That's what I've been living and breathing for 6 or 7 years. But when it comes to my own biology, I'm a total coward. I want to be absolutely sure that something works
right before
I actually put it in my body, especially if I'm making fundamental changes. So I'm all for enhancing myself, but I'm not going to be the first one going with a neuro implant or anything like that.
Sure. This is kind of a game theory argument, you know, where you kind of look at the possible outcomes and you assign probabilities to them of positive versus negative, and we're all kind of making these Bayesian, hopefully more closely to a Bayesian type analysis of what's going to be the best option, and we kind of have to move forward from there. I mean, there's always a chance you're going to get hit by a car crossing the street, but you're going to make that decision about how big that risk is and whether the reward is worth the risk.
All right. And the risk reward is different for different people, obviously.
Absolutely.
You know, Michael J. Fox, he'd had a neural implant, and the risk reward is much different for his brain,
mm-hmm,
and his brain than it would be for you, Nick. So, and perhaps that's how we make progress, is people that don't have much to lose are on the cutting edge, and they have to hack their bodies because they've got a serious problem, and then that ultimately benefits the rest of us.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave this topic. We've got a huge list of topics that we were planning to address tonight, and I want to hit one or two more of them anyway before we finish. Actually, we've got a question from the viewers. Someone writes in and says, how would we describe the singularity to the average man or the average lady on the street? I think that is a really interesting question. It kind of ties into something I wanted to get into tonight. One of the topics we talk about frequently on The World Transformed is this process of what R. Buckminster Fuller called ephemeralization, the ability to do more and more with less and less, the reduction of infrastructure and the reduction of time, the matter, energy, space, and time compression that's occurring around being able to do anything. The kind of the flip side of this enormous growth of capability that people are experiencing in this era. So Bucky's formulation was, the way he put it was, we're going to do more and more with less and less until eventually we do, you can do more and more with less and less until eventually you can do everything with nothing. Okay? So here's my question. Is that a fair description of the singularity to the average person on the street? And now that you're back live with us on video, PJ, I'm going to give that one to you first.
I was really hoping you'd go with someone else. you know, one of the issues that I see crop up continually, I'm not going to be able to answer your question because I'm going to have to answer it with a dilemma,
okay,
is that lots of people define the singularity in different ways. And it's a eternally frustrating, even among our own little futurist world, of what applies within the singularity and what doesn't. So I try to look at it this way, if I were to describe it to a layperson, and that is an increase in technology that allows humanity to achieve a form of intelligence not just beyond humanity, but that improves itself beyond what humans are capable of. And that's the broadest thing I can come up with. But apparently there are people who disagree with that description. And given that I do not claim to have the copyright on the singularity, I'd rather hear from other people.
I was going to say, I think Mr. Kurzweil has that copyright.
At least he's trying.
If anyone
knows. Lots of people would disagree with his definition, by the way. And if I can jump in, and of course I don't have the copyright of it, but I'm looking at a list that I compiled a couple of years ago of 17 definitions, and I stopped at 17 just because.
Okay, give us your favorite of 17. I don't think we want to hear all 17.
I just want to say before that PJ's definition is a popular one, but it's a very pro-transhumanist one. So she clearly comes from the transhumanist background where humanity is like an indelible part of the singularity, whereas we, as Bill Joy put it, the future doesn't need us, or at least doesn't necessarily need us. So in other words, humanity is not necessarily a feature of the singularity. We hope it will be, but it might not be. The definition that I like personally is two words, I.J. Good's traditional definition, and that's intelligence explosion. And when I elaborate on that, I usually say to people, what happens when your toothbrush is smarter than you? Right? What kind of world do we live in? What do you do when every object surrounding you is infinitely smarter than you, starting with your toothbrush or your toothpick, whatever? right? So that's the singularity for me in very, very brief description. And then you can elaborate infinitely on that, but the shortest way, I think, is intelligence explosion.
Please, Philip, go ahead.
Perhaps I can offer something that speaks directly to the question about Buckminster Fuller's ephemeralization. In a link that I'm sharing in the group chat right now, George Dvorsky yesterday published an interview with myself and another person in which I exactly discuss the opposite of doing more with less, in the sense that we discuss asymmetric destructive capability. And so to answer your question, is it the case that we can do ever more with ever less? Absolutely. And in the case of ADC, asymmetric destructive capability, it enables the bitter few, a team or even a single individual, to be extremely destructive thanks to and exacerbated by the nanobioinfo cognotechnological convergence. Whether that's you can call that the singularity or not, I'll leave in the middle, but the NBIC technological conversion that is underway is definitely enabling us technologically to do ever more with ever less.
So in some ways it becomes this question of whether, because I like Nick's answer, I like intelligence explosion around the singularity, but it comes down to who's driving. P-Day talks about it being something that involves us. Nick gives a scenario where maybe it doesn't. If it's us, then it's an intelligence explosion, but where it gets really interesting is it's a capability explosion. It's the ability to do all these things. If the intelligence explodes all around us and we're not along for the ride and suddenly we have infinitely intelligent and infinitely capable toothbrush, yeah, that's a very very strange future to move into. But what about that flip side of it, Philip, that you referenced, the capability to cause destruction, right? To cause mayhem. I guess when you talk about doing more and more with less and less, you can also be talking about doing more and more harm more easily, can't you?
Correct. And of course, it's always been the case that you can always destroy much more easily than you can build. But in the case of individuals or small teams bent on destroying and causing a lot of harm and a lot of deaths, it's very clear how they are empowered, how they use technology and the asymmetric, the development of this asymmetry that groups with very few resources can do asymmetrical amount of damage. Arguably, the starkest example of this, and I mention it in the interview, is in a not so far future where the resources needed to develop and deploy a nano weapon of mass destruction could be realized in as soon as 2040, give or take 10 years. So, in that scenario, it's chilling to realize that to pull off a big global-scale nanoweapon, a small determined team seeking massive destruction would need the following soon-to-be relatively modest resources. Off-the-shelf manufacturing equipment capable of creating the seed replobots, 4 mediocre nanoengineering PhDs, 4 off-the-shelf supercomputers, 4 and possibly less months of development time, and 4 dispersion points optimized for global prevailing wind patterns. That's it. And that with a team and resources that small, thanks to nanobioinfocogno converging technologies, you could potentially wipe out the human race.
Okay, well, I guess that's all the time we have, and that'll be our last thought on the show tonight. So that's a scary scenario right there, Philip. It truly is. And I wonder if the one silver lining there is that that capability curve is growing across the board, so that if the number of resources, the number of people, the number of staff hours that it takes to build a doomsday device has actually plummeted, And now it it takes so much less to make that possible. Then also, the size of the team, the amount of equipment that you have to spend with them, the amount of money you have to spend to put a group in place to prevent something like that from happening is enjoying the same benefit, right? So it's we end up with the same discussion we were just having about antibiotics almost, that we're all gaining capability at the same time, and it's a question of...
But let me just throw in the good news here, okay?
Please do.
I just watched an interview of Craig Venter on Charlie Rose, and that was, of course, one of the questions, and they were discussing it more in the context, of course, of bioweapons, not in nanotechnology per se. But Craig Venter, who has consulted both the Department of Defense and a number of other departments in the U.S. about the spread of biotechnology and the potential of developing bioweapons, said very specifically that in his opinion is the potentiality of doing good is increasing much faster than the potentiality of doing bad. And not only that, but in the last 2 or 3 years, the difference between the two has grown even more and faster than he originally told Charlie a couple of years ago. So, in other words, yes, you can do both good or bad, but at least in Craig Venter's opinion, when it comes to biotech weapons, the potential of doing good is greater and is growing faster, more rapidly than the potential of doing bad. So to me, that was fantastic because, I mean, Craig Venter should know what he's talking about, I think.
I hope he's right. Absolutely. That is tremendously encouraging, although that's not to say that the ability to do bad isn't growing rapidly. But I like the idea of, you know, we talk about an intelligence explosion, a capability explosion. A goodness explosion sounds like a model for the singularity that we might want to strive for. Stephen, we did a show called The Joy Explosion a few months ago, if you'll recall. That was kind of working along the same lines, talking about other ways of looking at the singularity. Anyone else with a good working person's person on the street definition of the singularity? Jason, anything to add to this?
Can you repeat the question again?
Just your quick, how would you define the singularity to a person on the street?
I would just define it as smart robots, creating more smart robots ad infinitum. And I kind of would like to conflate the term singularity and transhumanism a lot because it's so easy to mix up.
No, you had me with smart robots. I think smart robots building smart robots. You immediately people immediately get the picture in their head. Right? It's a good way to go. Stephen, anything?
I would. Depending on the audience that I'm trying to describe this to, I might say that singularity is a metaphor. It was taken from mathematics and from astrophysics. A singularity describes a black hole. A black hole has an event horizon that you can't see beyond. And the event horizon with a technological singularity is the point which beings, whether they be people or something else, becomes smarter than we are. My dog cannot predict my day, and what I do in my day has no idea what I do, and has no real understanding of it. Nor could I predict the day of someone who is infinitely smarter than I am. So that's what the singularity is about, in my opinion.
Actually, that's a good analogy. Whereas the infinitely smart toothbrush is a scary thought, but when you say to somebody, look, when you're as much smarter than you are now as you currently are than your dog, right? That's a picture people. I think they can have that in their mind. How about you, Frank? Anything to add to how we describe the singularity to the person in the street?
Well, I like Buckminster Fuller's definition, ephemeralism, the doing everything with nothing, because it's abstract. At first, I didn't like it. I thought it's too simple. It doesn't bring in the technology, the robots, the medicine. It goes on and on and on. But I liked, and the reason I like Buckminster Fuller's definition is because, in my mind, there's going to be a lot of skepticism in the general public. There are a few transhumanists eager to get these new gadgets that are measuring their blood pressure and their heart rate and their brain waves and yada, yada, yada. But the general public doesn't care. That's one thing we learned in the anti-aging medicine is that people, they're in a trance. They don't care. They don't want to tell them, hey, you can live to be 150. Well, I want to die. I want to die when I'm 86. So I think there's going to be a lot of skepticism. Some people don't. We don't want technology. We don't want biological weapons. There's going to be a lot. They can quickly you talk about any robots. We don't want robots. Any of these transhumanist programs will immediately get objections. But it's hard to object to doing everything with nothing.
Yeah, getting better at doing things is something that people, I think, can immediately latch onto. And also joy explosion. I think, you know, if you just coming from a marketing background, I think if you package that one right, people are going to be all over it. Okay, I can't believe it, but we're actually almost completely out of time. So we've had no time to get into post-scarcity, which was our other big topic for the evening. We were going to talk about 3D printers and advances that are being made there and what the world is going to look like in the near future when we have an economy potentially that is not based on scarcity. But I think we've probably just got time for maybe a parting shot from everyone. So I'll give you your choice of questions to answer. Pick one of the following questions to answer, because we have one more question from the viewers that I think is interesting. Someone says, it seems that technology is actually decelerating. So if you want to respond to the question, is technology decelerating, feel free to give an answer to that. Or if you'd like to tell what you're most looking forward to off your 3D printer when you have one of those, you can give us that answer instead, kind of taking the pro-technology standpoint. And Nick, I know you're a guy who's given a lot of thought to what he wants to do with this 3D printer, so I'm going to start with you, and feel free to answer either of those two questions.
How about a third one?
Sure, of course, yeah. You know.
You see, for me, it's not about a specific technology per se. That's why I don't want to get bogged down about 3D printing or nanotech. For me, it's about the coming together of all of those, you know, 10 or 12 different technologies, genetics, robotics. Philip was giving fantastic examples about quantified self, you know, infinite amount of sensors everywhere, artificial intelligence in the cloud, you name it. So for me, it's all about the coming together of all those things, and it always comes to the same things, which is questions of ethics and questions of identity, right? So first of all, who are we as a species? And second of all, who am I as an individual member of that species? So in other words, what is the meaning of humanity, if there is any definition? Because humanity was absolutely incapable, it seems to me, for the last N number of thousands of years to come up with a definition that we all accept of humanity. So, and then who are we as individual members of that species of humanity? Right, so those are to me the big questions. And then technology is basically just shaping the context within which we come up with answers to those questions. So for example, if you're a transhumanist, you would say, I am that person who is a process, like me, for example. I am not an entity, I'm a process. I am in development. So hopefully I get better intellectually, physically, in every way as I progress in time, which is what transhumanism is all about, right? Progress, improvement of some sort. And technology is just a tool that allows us to improve or enhance that process. But as it does that, then it feeds back into the loop and changes the very meaning of who we are, both individually and collectively. So for me, it's always about that. It's not about the specific means. It's about the bigger picture.
Beautiful. Great stuff, Nick. I couldn't agree with you more on that. But I'd want to swing it around then, because are you saying then that you don't think technology is decelerating?
I absolutely do not think it's decelerating.
Okay,
I think.
I just want to see if anybody's going to chime in on that one.
There is no doubt in my mind that it's accelerating. You know, I'm getting up at say 8 o'clock and I go until midnight, and that's all I do all day long, and it's absolutely impossible for me to keep up with it. And I've been doing it for 6 years, and I know that when I started, I was somewhat able to keep up. Now it's beyond hopeless. I'm still doing it, but with my limited CPU power, it's a hopeless struggle in many ways. So I know for a fact that from where I'm sitting, and after interviewing 130 of the most incredible people that I've been lucky to talk to, there's no doubt in my mind that it is absolutely exploding.
Okay, well, don't give up. We need you to keep doing exactly what you're doing, and we very much appreciate it. All right. Parting thoughts. Please, Philip.
I would chime in with Nick that technology is indeed accelerating, but frankly, it's not going at the same speed in all the fields, and in general, it's still not going fast enough. I think they need to hurry up, especially in the life sciences, because we're not getting any younger, and even though all these technologies are accelerating, big breakthroughs need to happen for uploading and radical life extension and immortality to happen. So it's accelerating, but we should push the pedal to the metal even more and help science realize all of these lofty ambitions. So I think we have extremely interesting times ahead. We have some tough times ahead as well, because the societal disruptions caused by these transitional times from a scarcity-based world to an abundance world is not going to be easy. It's like a birth where the mother is in pain and the baby is under stress and there's blood and it's messy. But after the thing is done, everybody's extremely happy with the newborn baby. But still, you know, the transitional time is tough. And so I'm concerned about those disruptions, and at the same time, I'm very exhilarated about the prospects of the technology and science bonanza that's ahead of us. I can't wait.
All right. What is it the man says? Faster, please. And I agree completely. Stephen, how about you? Parting thoughts?
Yeah, I think that the general public has gotten real good at tuning a lot of this out. You know, Nick spends all of his time every day trying to keep up with this and is finding that he can't. I think that the general public just has thrown up their hands, and so they're not trying to keep up with it. And so to some extent, they're just not hearing about it. That's part of it. I think the other part of it is ephemeralization. If everything's disappearing into smaller and smaller devices, then maybe that's another way of just not knowing what our capabilities are, a lot of people, and so that just it's happening under the noses of everyone, and so I say that as an explanation of why someone could possibly think that, but yes, absolutely, things are improving at a faster and faster rate.
Okay, great. Frank, any parting thoughts? I should say to our last few people, I'm going to give a parting shot to you. You got about a minute each, so I gave all the time to the earlier people. Sorry about that. So take it away, Frank.
Okay. I would say that technology is accelerating rapidly and faster. That's the transhumanist thing. But there is this atrophy in industry, corporations, government, institutions, they're all they want to do is make a buck. And that's not, I think we need to improve our thinking in that area, basing whether we're going to do something or not, develop a technology or whatever, is all based on if we can make a fast buck. And I think that's a bad philosophy. We need to collaborate more and make it a better planet. I think that's what I would sum it up.
All right, very good. Jason, parting thoughts.
Is technology accelerating? I say no. I say technology is accelerating rapidly and exponentially, but rate of adoption might be slow in the developed world. And what do I want to 3D print? I would say myself, to achieve immortality, but there's also the problem of whether that's actually me or not. And post-scarcity economy, it would sound really nice, and I think there's going to be a problem of robots taking our jobs and technological unemployment and what major social changes will take place from that.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, printing myself is that's a long-range goal. I think if I could just replace a certain knee, it would be a great start for me. But Paul, you're going to get the second to last word here.
Yeah, I agree with Nicola quite a bit. I don't really the most important thing, technology is just a reflection of humanity, both in its use and in its creation. So the most important question is first figuring out, I think, that who we are is a good idea. Also, I've created kind of my own framework where I play around on not only where we are, but where we want to get to and how we can get there. I have a framework that I've worked out that I'd love to share with anybody about how we can start investigating those questions in a more cerebral type way.
And you're just going to stop it with you've got the framework. You're not going to.
I have a framework. I'm happy to share, but we don't have time.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll pick that up on a World Transformed coming up in the near future. Okay.
Sure. A framework. Let's say a framework, not the framework.
Okay. All right. We'll call it a framework for now. All right. Well, listen. I so appreciate everyone participating this evening. Thanks to the Singularity Network, to all our friends both from the World Transformed and Singularity Network for making this evening possible. Thanks for everyone's patience as we dealt with the technological glitches. This is for Stephen and myself, first time we've tried doing this. I think the Singularity Network had a little bit of experience going in, but we're working our way through the technology. What's important is we all got together and had a chance to talk about these topics, and I especially thank those who've been watching the broadcast or those who are watching it now on YouTube or listening via iTunes. Thanks for being part of Singularity Network Hangout. Thanks for being part of the World Transformed. Look us up. Look up Singularity Network on Facebook and on Google+. Go to worldtransformed.com and find out about the program. We love talking with you about these things. And until next time, see you.